You know, it's funny how often we tend to just sort of brush aside things that we can't directly see or touch or immediately explain.
Yeah.
Like it's almost this reflex in our modern Western mindset to relegate anything outside our everyday experience to the realm of, folklore or superstition, like demons, for
Yeah,
instance.
for a lot of people, it's just, oh, spooky stories, campfire tales, nothing more.
Right. But today, you've brought some fascinating material to the table.
I have.
Material that challenges us to look at things from a very different angle.
Yes, we are. We're diving into some accounts, biblical accounts, of Jesus interacting with what these texts describe as the spirit realm.
Okay.
And we're going to zoom in specifically on these entities called demons.
So we've got excerpts from A Course on Miracles by Dr. Robert C. Newman.
That's right.
And the session we're focusing on today is session 7, Jesus Miracles Over the Spiritual Realm.
Okay.
And what's really interesting is how this session builds on earlier discussions in Dr. Newman's course,
Yes.
where he looks at Jesus's miracles in the natural world, like the calming of the storm, and also his healings within the human realm, like curing diseases.
That's right.
So this session, it's like we're moving into this other dimension of the miraculous.
Exactly. Yeah. It's this aspect that's often debated, questioned, even dismissed, as we were saying earlier.
Exactly.
But these ancient narratives, they've got a lot to unpack there.
They do. So our mission for this deep dive is pretty clear.
Okay.
We really want to get a grip on how these sources portray Jesus's encounters with these, well, demonic beings.
Yeah.
We want to look at the historical context,
Right.
consider some of the alternative explanations that have been proposed,
Yeah.
the challenges to these accounts, and ultimately try to understand what their significance could be.
Okay, sounds good.
And as always, we're sticking closely to the material you brought,
Absolutely, staying focused.
giving our listeners a really focused look at this, well, frankly, pretty intriguing territory.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating.
So let's jump right into a story that's, well, it's pretty dramatic.
Okay.
The account of the Gadarene demoniacs.
Yeah, that one's a real, it grabs your attention. You find it in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8.
Okay.
And there are parallel accounts in Mark chapter 5 and Luke chapter 8.
Gotcha.
So Matthew tells us that Jesus, he arrives on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Gadarenes, and he's immediately confronted by these two men possessed by demons
Okay.
living among the tombs.
Oh.
And the text, it doesn't hold back. It emphasizes how violent they were,
Really?
so dangerous that nobody dared travel that road.
Oh, wow. I mean, that paints a picture of a community that's just totally helpless.
Yeah, completely at their mercy.
And then these men, or I guess the beings inside them, they address Jesus directly.
They do.
They cry out, "What do you want with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?"
Yeah, a pretty bold question.
It is, and it's packed with theological weight.
It is.
Like they instantly recognize Jesus's identity, the Son
Yes.
of God, and they even talk about this future judgment.
An appointed time, that's right.
So the story continues. There's this herd of pigs grazing nearby,
Okay.
and the demons, they actually plead with Jesus.
They do. They say, if you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs.
Really? Into the pigs?
Into the pigs.
And what does Jesus say?
Simple. One word. Go.
Wow. And then?
And then chaos. Absolute chaos.
Oh, I bet.
The demons, they leave the men, enter the pigs, and this entire herd, they stampede down a steep bank into the lake.
Into the lake.
Into the lake, and they all drown.
Oh my gosh. You can almost hear the snorts and the splashes and just the sheer panic.
You can. And you can understand why the swineherds, they just completely freaked out.
Oh, me too.
They run to the town, report everything,
Wow.
including the amazing change in the men who had been possessed.
Right, because now they're.
Now they're totally normal. And the whole town, they come out to meet Jesus.
Do they welcome him?
Not exactly. They're actually kind of terrified.
Right.
They beg him to leave their region.
That does seem counterintuitive. Like, if you were making up a story, you'd think they'd be grateful.
Right. But this is where it gets interesting because Dr. Newman, he brings up some liberal explanations for this whole event.
Liberal explanations.
Yeah, and he's referencing Alfred Plummer here.
Okay.
So these explanations, they range from the whole thing being a myth to a real healing happening, but without the pigs involved at all.
Interesting.
Or maybe the demoniac somehow just accidentally scared the pigs into the water.
Right, okay.
And then there's the idea that the men were just, you know, mentally ill.
Okay.
And Jesus was sort of playing along with their delusion about demons and pigs.
I see. So these interpretations, they're trying to find explanations that fit within a worldview that maybe doesn't easily accept the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
So what does the source offer as evidence for the historicity of this account?
Okay, so it points to the specific details, the location, the other side, the tombs, the steep slope.
Okay.
It's like, could these be real geographic markers?
Right.
Then there's the different names for the region, Gadara, Gerasa, Gergesa.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe these variations actually point to some historical connections.
Like what?
Like, maybe they're tied to the Decapolis cities around the Sea of Galilee.
Ah, the Decapolis.
And their economic activities, fishing rights, things like that.
Oh, that makes sense.
There's even a suggestion that Gerasa might correspond to a modern village called Kersey.
So, a real place.
Yeah, a potential link to a tangible location.
Interesting. And what about the townspeople's reaction? Asking Jesus to leave.
Right, so the source suggests they were worried, deeply worried, about the economic loss of their pigs.
Okay, yeah. That was their livelihood.
Exactly. So if Jesus has this kind of power over, you know, evil forces,
yeah,
who knows what else he might do.
Right. And they probably wouldn't even dare ask him to, like, bring their pigs back.
Probably not. It really shows how his presence was just so disruptive.
It was. Okay, so what about those eyewitness elements in the gospel accounts?
Well, you've got the pigs stampeding,
mm-hmm.
the herders running away,
yeah.
and then the formerly tormented men being in their right minds.
Back to normal.
Yeah, back to normal. And Mark's gospel adds this really interesting detail.
That's that.
The man who had been possessed, he wants to follow Jesus.
Oh, wow. Okay, so let's shift gears a bit and talk about the Old Testament.
Okay.
The source points out something really interesting.
What's that?
Explicit encounters with demons are actually pretty rare in the Old Testament.
Compared to
what we find in pagan writings, rabbinic literature, things like that.
Yeah, that's true. It's a noticeable difference.
So why might that be?
Well, the source suggests there's this idea in the Old Testament that demonic influence might be behind, like, pagan religious practices.
I see.
And then there's the example of King Saul. You know, after God's favor shifted to David, Saul goes through all this turmoil.
Yeah.
And some people interpret that as a form of, like, demonic oppression.
Ah,
and
yes.
Remember those Egyptian magicians?
During Moses' time.
Yeah, the plagues and all that. They're seemingly supernatural powers. Some might say those were demonic in origin.
Oh, that's an interesting angle.
It is, isn't it?
So the source brings in this analogy from Os Guinness.
Oh, yeah, the campfire effect.
Yeah, the campfire effect.
Yeah.
Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. So Guinness uses this analogy to describe how interest in the occult or, you know, demonic activity seems to have increased in Western culture since the 1960s.
Okay.
So he compares Christianity to this big, bright campfire in a dark wilderness.
Okay, I like this already.
Right. When the fire's strong, wild animals stay away.
Makes sense.
But when the fire starts to die down, well,
the animals get closer.
Exactly. And in this analogy, those animals represent negative spiritual influences.
I see. So the idea is that as Christian influence wanes, those influences feel bolder, like they can come out of the shadows.
That's the idea. It's a metaphor, of course, but it's a striking one.
It is. So are there Old Testament examples where we see God or even Satan controlling animals directly?
There are, yeah. For God's control, there's that story of Jacob and Laban's sheep.
Oh, right, with the different colored sheep being born.
Yeah, and then the plagues in Egypt.
The frogs, the locusts, all that.
Exactly. And don't forget the provision of quail in the wilderness.
Right.
Balaam's donkey talking.
Okay.
The cows that carried the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
Ravens feeding Elijah.
Yeah.
Bears attacking those who mocked Elisha.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got Daniel in the lion's den.
Right. But that's all God. What about Satan?
For Satan, or demonic influence, the source mentions the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
The serpent, yeah, the tempter.
Uh-huh. And then there's the manipulation of the Sabaeans and Chaldeans against Job.
Oh, yeah, leading to him losing all his livestock.
Exactly. And the troubling of Saul, that's another one.
Right.
So it seems like the Old Testament presents a more, I don't know, maybe subtle or indirect view of these spiritual forces.
Like they're at work, but not always front and center.
Right.
Okay, there's that interesting account of a lying spirit influencing the false prophets in 1 Kings 22.
Oh, yeah, that one's fascinating.
The source also mentions how the Old Testament doesn't talk about Satan all that much directly.
Yeah, it's not like he's a main character or anything.
Right.
There's his role in inciting David to take that census in 1 Chronicles 21.
Okay.
And then his accusations against Job in the book of Job.
Job, yeah.
And Psalm 109.6, where Satan's described as an adversary.
Okay.
Which some scholars connect to Judas's betrayal.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, and there's his accusation against Joshua the high priest in Zechariah.
Mm.
The source even mentions that tricky passage in Genesis 6 about the sons of God and the daughters of men.
Oh, yeah, that one's been debated for centuries.
For sure. But the key point is the closest Old Testament parallel to Gadarene demoniacs is that story in Zechariah.
Okay.
But even there, it's about deliverance from Satan's accusations.
Not possession.
Right, not possession like we see with the Gadarene demoniacs.
Okay, so what's the big takeaway from this whole event in the Gadarenes?
Well, on a very basic level, two men are freed.
Freed from what?
From Satan's control.
Okay.
And significantly, if you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke together,
yeah,
it seems that one of these men becomes a follower of Jesus.
Wow. So pretty dramatic transformation.
Yeah, a complete 180. And then there's the economic side of things, the Gadarenes losing their pigs.
Right, right.
Which probably factored into them wanting Jesus gone.
Yeah, they're probably thinking this guy's bad for business.
Maybe, yeah.
The source mentions this theme of deliverance judgment. What does that mean?
It's the idea that this exorcism, it's not just about freeing these men.
Okay.
It's also a judgment against the demonic forces themselves.
I see.
A display of Jesus's power to overcome them.
So zooming out a bit, thinking about the overall story of salvation history.
Okay.
The source suggests this apparent increase in demonic activity in the time between the Old and New Testaments.
The intertestamental period, yeah.
Right. That maybe it was due to Gentile influences or even resistance to the coming Messiah.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. Like maybe the demonic realm was anticipating the arrival of Jesus and trying to oppose it in some way.
Okay, and back to that moment in the Gadarenes. Jesus just says, go. And these powerful entities are forced to obey.
Right. It's pretty striking.
It is. The source asks a question that really got me thinking.
What's that?
Did Jesus intentionally use the pigs to get rid of the demons?
Yeah. Or did the demons seize the opportunity to cause chaos and maybe even get away from Jesus?
Right. It's like, who was really calling the shots there?
It's a good question. And the text doesn't really give us a clear answer.
It doesn't, does it? But the main point seems to be
that Jesus's authority, it goes beyond just the natural world and physical healing.
Okay.
It extends into the spiritual realm.
He's got power over these demonic beings.
Exactly.
And there's some really interesting symbolic layers there, too.
Yeah, like foreshadowing Satan's ultimate defeat and the final judgment.
Okay, yeah. And remember the demon's question about being tortured before the appointed time.
That's right. It ties right in.
Okay, let's move on to another account that's, well, it's just full of emotional depth.
All right.
The story of the daughter of the Syrophoenician woman.
Okay, that one's a powerful one. It's in Mark's gospel, starting around chapter 7, verse 24.
Okay.
And there's a parallel account in Matthew 15.
Gotcha. So what happens?
Okay, so Jesus, after a period of intense ministry, he withdraws to the region of Tyre.
Tyre.
Yeah, seeking some privacy.
But I guess that didn't last long.
Not really, no. This Greek woman from Syrian Phoenicia. Yeah, so she's a Gentile. And her young daughter is possessed by an evil spirit. And she hears about Jesus.
Okay.
And she seeks him out.
What does she do?
Mark describes her falling at Jesus' feet, begging him.
Oh, wow. She's desperate.
She pleads with him to cast the demon out of her daughter.
And what does Jesus say?
His response is unexpected.
Really? What does he say?
He tells her, first, let the children eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs.
To the dogs. That sounds harsh.
Yeah, on the surface it does. The children are generally understood to be the people of Israel.
Okay.
And dogs was often a derogatory term for Gentiles.
So he's essentially saying
he's prioritizing the Jewish people, but the woman, her response is amazing.
What does she say?
She says, yes, Lord, she replies, but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.
Oh, wow.
Quick thinking and deeply humble.
It is. Like she's acknowledging the hierarchy, but still making her case.
Exactly. And Jesus recognizes that.
Yeah.
He sees her faith, her understanding. He says, for such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter.
Oh, wow.
So the woman returns home and her daughter is completely healed.
Just like that. So the source places this event later in Jesus's ministry.
Yes, a time when he's focusing on teaching his disciples.
Okay.
It happens after that intense opposition from the Pharisees.
Right.
And before the feeding of the 4,000.
Okay.
And it takes place in Gentile territory.
That's significant.
It is. The fact that this Gentile woman recognizes Jesus's authority
mm-hmm.
and seeks his help.
Powerful. So what are the naturalistic explanations for this one?
Most lean towards psychosomatic healing.
Psychosomatic.
Yeah, because they don't believe in demons.
Okay, so it's all in her head, basically.
Essentially, yeah. But the source, it highlights how this account fits with the other gospel narratives.
Okay.
How the woman is consistently identified as a Canaanite in Matthew, a Greek Syrophoenician in Mark.
Right.
It mentions the specific location, Tyre and Sidon.
Yeah.
And Jesus's way of speaking, those challenging remarks.
Right. Those are all kind of trademarks.
They are, yeah. So all of that points to its historicity.
Okay, so what Old Testament examples does the source bring up involving Gentiles
yeah.
who experience God's intervention?
Oh, there are a few. Naaman the Syrian being cured of leprosy by Elisha.
Oh, right, right.
And then there's Elijah providing food for the widow of Zarephath.
Yeah, and raising her son.
Exactly. And the miracles involving Pharaoh during the Exodus.
The plagues.
The plagues. And then there's Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon.
He had some interesting experiences with the God of Israel, didn't he?
He did. And all these examples, they show God interacting with and intervening in the lives of those outside the Jewish covenant.
That's important. So in the Old Testament, there's this big separation between Jews and Gentiles.
Yes.
Which helps us understand why Jesus responds to this woman the way he does.
Exactly.
And why her persistence is so remarkable.
Right. It's also worth remembering how dogs were viewed in the ancient Near East, often seen as unclean.
Yeah.
But sometimes kept as pets, too.
So it's not a simple black and white thing.
Right. It's more nuanced than that.
Okay. So what are the implications of this miracle, both in the immediate sense and more broadly?
Well, immediately, you've got a remote exorcism.
Remote.
Jesus isn't physically present.
Right.
He doesn't even directly address the demon.
And yet the girl is healed.
Healed, yeah. And the woman's faith in the face of that initial, you know, seeming rejection.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It is. So this really underscores the theme of God's grace extending to the Gentiles.
It does, yeah. Which is a central theme in Luke's gospel.
Right, right.
But it's definitely present here, too.
In Matthew and Mark.
Yeah. And in terms of salvation history, this event, it points towards the gospel eventually reaching all nations.
Even though the initial focus is on the Jewish people.
Yeah. The Jews first, then the Gentiles.
And the source makes a pretty bold claim.
What's that?
That this might be the most striking recorded exorcism.
It's definitely up there because it's remote.
Yeah.
And the recipient is a Gentile.
Both unusual.
Exactly.
Okay, the woman's analogy of the dogs and the crumbs.
Oh, yeah, that's packed with meaning.
What kind of meaning?
It's like a prediction.
Okay.
A literary device called synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
Where a part represents the whole.
Gotcha.
So here, her plea for even the crumbs of Jesus's ministry.
Yeah.
It signifies how the Gentiles will eventually be included in God's blessings.
After Jesus's ascension.
Exactly. This one encounter, it's like a sneak peek.
A sneak peek of what's to come.
Yeah. A glimpse of a major development in God's plan.
Okay. Last account for today. The healing of the possessed boy.
Okay. Let's dive into that one.
It's in Mark. Starting around chapter 9, verse 14.
Right.
Parallels. Matthew 17 and Luke 9.
Yep.
So Jesus, Peter, James, and John, they're coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration.
Okay.
What do they find?
Well, the other disciples are surrounded by this big crowd.
Oh.
Yeah. And there are teachers of the law there, too.
Oh, boy.
It seems like there's an argument going on.
Really?
And Mark notes that when the crowd sees Jesus, they're astonished.
Awestruck?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, so this father comes forward from the crowd.
He does.
What does he say?
He's brought his son, who's possessed by a spirit that makes him unable to speak.
So the boy's mute.
Mute. And the father described how this spirit just seizes the boy.
Like out of the blue.
Yeah, and throws him to the ground.
Oh, no.
Foaming at the mouth, grinding his teeth, going rigid.
Oh, that's awful.
It's terrible.
So the father, he must be desperate.
Oh, he is. He tells Jesus that he asked the disciples to cast out the spirit, but they couldn't.
They couldn't.
Nope.
And what does Jesus say to that?
He's clearly exasperated.
Yeah.
He says, oh, unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me.
Wow. Strong words.
They are.
So they bring the boy to Jesus.
They do. And as soon as the boy's near Jesus, the spirit reacts violently.
What does it do?
Throws him into convulsions on the ground.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
So Jesus asks how long this has been going on.
He does, yeah. And the father says, since childhood.
Oh, wow, since he was a little boy.
Imagine that. So the father, just overwhelmed, he pleads with Jesus.
What does he say?
But if you can do anything, he says, take pity on us and help us.
So much pain in those words.
So much pain.
What does Jesus say?
Jesus says, if you can, everything is possible for one who believes.
Oh, I love that.
And the father's response, it's just so real, so human.
What does he say?
He says, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief.
Oh, it's faith, but it's also doubt, all mixed together.
It's so relatable, isn't it?
It is.
And then, noticing the crowd gathering, Jesus rebukes the spirit.
What does he say?
I command you, come out of him and never enter him again.
Powerful.
Powerful stuff. The spirit, it screams, throws the boy into one last convulsion.
And then
it leaves. The boy lies still, seems like he's dead.
Oh, no.
But Jesus takes him by the hand, lifts him up, and he's fine.
Wow, amazing.
Oh.
So later, the disciples ask Jesus why they couldn't cast out the spirit.
Yeah, they're confused.
And what does Jesus say?
This kind can come out only by prayer.
Prayer.
And some early manuscripts add, and fasting.
Interesting. So the source emphasizes the connection to the transfiguration.
Yeah, this event happens right after.
Okay.
And you've got the disciples failing, the scribes criticizing them.
It's a tense scene.
It is. And the common naturalistic explanation is epilepsy.
Epilepsy, okay.
And to be fair, some of the boy's symptoms do sound like that.
That's true.
But the source, it points to the consistency of the three gospel accounts.
Yeah.
Despite those minor variations.
Right.
And that amazing detail of the father's simultaneous belief and doubt.
Yeah, that really gets to me.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth noting that only Luke mentions the crowd's astonishment after the healing.
Okay.
Like they were blown away.
So are there similar Old Testament examples?
Well, the source reminds us that demonic possession isn't talked about much in the Old Testament.
Right.
But the closest parallel is probably King Saul being troubled by an evil spirit in 1 Samuel.
Okay, yeah. And we also see cases where the Spirit of God directly influences people.
Like when?
Like when the Spirit stops Saul from harming David in 1 Samuel 19.
Oh, right, right.
So what are the immediate consequences of this miracle?
Well, you've got that final violent act by the demon.
Yeah.
And then the boy's healing.
Which could even be seen as a resurrection.
Possibly, yeah. The crowd's amazed.
Understandably.
And the disciples are confused.
Yeah.
About their failure.
Right. So this event really reinforces Jesus' ultimate authority.
It does, yeah.
Showing that even demons have to submit to him.
Exactly.
Okay. Jesus talks about the unbelieving generation and the need for prayer, possibly even fasting.
Right.
What's the significance of those statements?
Well, it gets into this whole discussion about the nature of faith and its role in these kinds of situations.
All right.
The source emphasizes that faith here, it's probably best understood as deep trust in God's power.
Not some kind of magical ability that we can just wield.
Right, exactly. It's about where we place our trust. Even a tiny bit of faith directed at God can accomplish amazing things.
Like that mustard seed moving mountains.
Exactly.
Oh, unbelieving generation. Who's he talking about?
Well, it's not totally clear.
Okay.
The source says it could be the people right there in front of him.
Okay.
Or the Israelites more broadly.
Right.
Or even just humanity in general. You know, our tendency toward unbelief since the fall.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then there's the emphasis on prayer and possibly fasting.
Yeah, yeah.
It suggests these are crucial ways to seek God's help.
Especially when dealing with these powerful spiritual forces.
Exactly. And it seems the disciples hadn't really relied on these practices before Jesus arrived.
Okay, so any symbolic or, you know, end times related dimensions to this account?
The source suggests it might foreshadow God's final victory over all demonic activity.
At the end of time.
At the end of time.
Okay, so we've covered those three really powerful accounts.
I have.
Now, the source offers some concluding thoughts about the overall significance of Jesus' miracles. Expert speaker.
Yeah.